This is Law and Disorder.
As we begin 2008, we mark the sixth anniversary of the Guantanamo detention centers.
Half the detainees have been freed, 300 still remain, and the U.S. continues to operate detention centers around the world.
We'll talk with Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Pardis Cabriai, who's at a conference in Yemen, talking about the nearly 100 detainees at Guantanamo from that country. We'll also talk with Jumana Musa from Amnesty International about the recent demonstrations drawing attention to the plight of Guantanamo detainees and to other detainees around the world. Center for Constitutional Rights Executive Director Vince Warren joins us live from D.C. He participated in some of the demonstrations drawing attention to Guantanamo. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Michael, we've just marked the sixth anniversary, if you can believe it, of Guantanamo Bay, and we had protests a few days ago in D.C. and all around the country. Tell us briefly, what's changed for the good?
What's changed for the good, at least people are paying attention to Guantanamo. We've gotten half the people out. There were originally 600 or 700 in there. There's now about just under 300. What hasn't changed for the good, Heidi, is there's still 300. We've been to the Supreme Court twice and won. Twice Congress has reversed our victories. Now we're in the Supreme Court for a third time, hopefully on the issue of habeas corpus that will be given to our detainees, we hope, but we're not sure. For me, it's a long time because the Center for Constitutional Rights and I actually brought the first case on Guantanamo. The first person went there, David Hicks, along with some others, on January 11th of 2002. I got his name or the name of his lawyer from a newspaper, contacted them in Australia, and began the first habeas corpus case. So 6 years is a very long time to be fighting to get a day in court. We haven't yet had a day in court where the government has been forced to come forward with its evidence. That's what we've been trying to get. The Bush administration has resisted and resisted and resisted. Hopefully this year, 2008, we'll begin to see the final phase in the Guantanamo chapter. But I say that hopefully because I could have said that last year and the year before.
I think the Atlantic Monthly is doing a photo spread this month on Guantanamo, and it's true that we still read about things in the mass media. One concern, though, is with sort of the routinization, I hate to say that, but the routinization of torture that we've been seeing in terms of extraordinary renditions and this government's discussion over what constitutes torture, the tapes, the fact that the CIA destroyed tapes, but really the contents of the tapes were something that we should all be outraged about. Even though it's still covered in the media, do you fear that the public is becoming a little jaded after 6 years?
Well, I'm afraid so, Heidi, and it's on a number of these issues that have really been of great concern to all of us since 9/11. It's the indefinite detentions, or what you'd have to call preventive detention at Guantanamo. It's the detentions and disappearances of people all over the world into secret CIA sites. It's currently the continuation of a prison in Bagram, Afghanistan. Think about that for a second. We've gotten 600 lawyers into Guantanamo. We haven't gotten one lawyer into Bagram.
Which is huge.
It's probably double or triple the size of what's left at Guantanamo, 600 or 700 people. And let me say, without lawyers, torture rears its head not just by chance, but they want to be able to torture people to so-called get information, is their claim. But of course, I don't think that's the case. But in fact, so Bagram is sitting out there. We're all focused on Guantanamo and shutting it down. So really, our belief is you shut down Guantanamo, you shut down all offshore prison colonies, you shut down all secret sites, and you end torture. So I think the sad part is in a certain way, we've lost. I mean, in a certain way, yes, we've freed a bunch of Guantanamo people, a lot of them. Yes, we've probably stopped torture mostly at Guantanamo. But in Bagram, for all I know, and I'm pretty convinced the so-called Rumsfeld techniques of torture are still continuing. Certainly the administration has said they want to continue those at various secret sites. Congress has sadly, including a lot of Democrats, has gone along with this program. We haven't yet seen a serious hearing on chain of command on torture. We haven't yet seen a serious hearing on closing down secret sites. We haven't yet seen a hearing on the rendition policy and one that goes up the chain of command and tries to prosecute people. So the question is whether, even if we beat back particular struggles in this, whether now really embedded in our law and in our precedents is the idea that the U.S. can respond to acts of terror essentially in an off-the-chart, unlawful, inhumane and immoral manner.
And certainly with our new Supreme Court, which has a sorry record already of essentially rubber stamping whatever the Bush administration wants to do, does not bode well for certain future decisions. But what do you think about the presidential candidates? And do you think any will be strong in terms of standing up for human rights violations in Guantanamo and Bagram?
Well, we can pretty much dismiss the Republicans. I mean, certainly Romney and Giuliani, probably Huckabee on this issue as well, but Romney and Giuliani have been particularly bad on both Guantanamo. Romney said he wanted to double the size of Guantanamo. Giuliani and Romney both talked about the use of enhanced interrogation techniques and thought you should do whatever you want. Huckabee at least said he didn't like waterboarding. Of course, better on torture is John McCain, probably better on Guantanamo as well, because he himself was subjected to various techniques, according to him, in Vietnam. He is better on these issues. Ron Paul is certainly better on these issues. Now, the Democrats, let's assume a Democrat's going to win. Let's assume that what they have done is almost all of them, basically all of them, all of the front runners for sure, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and Edwards, have all essentially caused for an end to torture and an end to Guantanamo. But, you know, what that means in practice, Heidi, I think is the big issue. You know, the center and I litigated the Haitian refugee cases in 91, 93, when we had all the Haitians imprisoned at Guantanamo who were supposedly HIV positive. That was done under Bush 1. Clinton was running for office. We actually had a meeting with Clinton and maybe a meeting with Hillary as well. We were really promised that they would lift the HIV exemption, essentially that they would close Guantanamo, they would stop returning refugees to Haiti. And of course, even a few days before Clinton took office, he reversed himself, the promises to us, and we had to actually litigate the closing of the HIV camp at Guantanamo. While they have said these words, they'll close Guantanamo and stop torture, that doesn't mean anything. And what it really leads to, in my view, is you can't accept what they say. You have to continue incredible activism. That's what we did in the 91-93 Haitian cases. And that's what I think you saw on January 11th. You saw demonstrations everywhere, vigils in New York, huge demonstrations in Washington, demonstrations really around the world to close down Guantanamo, close secret sites, end torture. And unless you keep that issue active, this is not a central issue of the campaigns. It's not something the Democrats debate a lot. They don't want to be seen, in their view, as weak on terrorism, and they consider this part of the fight on terror, even though it's an off-the-wall, illegal, immoral way to do that battle. So it's not become a major public issue, both out there as well as within the campaigns.
We always say here on Law and Disorder is just an integral part of supporting legal justice movements. We interviewed Brant Goldstein a year or so ago, whose book Storming the Court talked, in fact, about students and organizing on those Haitian detainee cases. So
that's actually a really important point. You know, we continued litigating the Haitian cases under Clinton, and we won a victory in the district court. And certainly, I think that could have been appealed. I mean, there was a lot of reasons one could appeal that order. It was, you know, the idea that essentially you wound up letting Haitian HIV-positive people into the U.S. was something that, an appeals court might well have looked at. Clinton didn't appeal, and The Nation, I remember writing an editorial saying really what was key here, why they didn't appeal, was because of the activism around the country. There was something called Operation Harriet Tubman, named after the great African-American leader, Harriet Tubman, and it was hunger strikes and cages being built at universities and colleges across the country. And that was certainly part of the activism. There was a very active HIV/AIDS community, ACT UP. There were immigrant activists, there were Haitian activists, there were African-American activists. So we essentially precluded the Clinton administration from appealing. There was just too much pressure. Congress actually had a vote. They tried to get a vote that it should be appealed. But because of the activism, which The Nation noted in its article, there was no appeal.
You know, one final point that I find interesting is that with the whole Christian right and the issue of morality about torture, which I think it really is when you're looking at national security and people are justifying torture in the name of that, aside from the fact that we don't get good evidence from it, there's a highly moral issue of how this sort of reflects on our society. And where has the Christian right been in terms of condemning torture?
I think it's complicated. I think I would not say most of them have been out there, but there is a group of evangelicals who I have actually been on a platform with, who have actually spoken out against torture. And of course, in the religious community, there's actually a religious task force made up of all the major and even minor religions that is opposed to torture. Some people have told me they think it's probably the best hope for really trying to stop it. But, you know, I'm not clear because, you know, as you and I have covered on this program, torture as an abstraction, torture as a means of getting information is probably not what torture is about. It's about whether, as one of our guests here talked about declining empire, about terrorizing a population, about telling people if you go against this, you will be tortured. So it's not just by putting up a sign saying we shall not torture, it's immoral. It really is in a contextual sense, a part and parcel of sad to say, who an imperialist United States is, actually.
Well, as we embark on our sixth year, we'll have to keep the fight in the streets strong for Guantanamo and other such unlawful prisons. This past week, we've had two notable developments, one positive and one very sad. The first is that we have a victory in what's been come to know, be known as the Central Park Great Lawn lawsuit. A group of attorneys in D.C., members of the National Lawyers Guild from the Partnership for Civil Justice, sued the city during the Republican convention when the city refused to let the National Council of Arab Americans and the Answer Coalition stage a protest on the Great Lawn. The city's argument was that it would hurt the grass.
I remember, Heidi, seeing all these pictures of the grass in the newspaper and the roots and all this stuff. You know, they wanted to turn it into a putting green, according to them, you know, which basically allowed a few rich people with clubs to go on there and, like, putt golf. But anyway.
So we had litigation for 3 years and a victory the other day in that the city has to establish a constitutionally valid permitting scheme for protest in Central Park. And they have to do a feasibility study into the optimum and sustainable use of the Great Lawn for future rallies and demonstrations. They also have to pay $500,000 in attorney's fees.
Oh,
and
wow.
Each of the two groups gets $25,000.
That's incredible.
Right?
$500,000. That'll fund the Partnership for Civil Justice for some years.
But, you know, when I think about this, it is a major victory because it was really an outrage when it happened. It was obviously a political decision at bottom. Bloomberg, who was a Republican at the time, he's like a chameleon, but he was a Republican right then, didn't want a big demonstration in the park. And so they came up with this phony excuse. But what's sad about it, even though it's a victory, is essentially the right that people had to protest is gone. So they paid $500,000 to not have a demonstration.
Yeah. Paid $500,000 out of our dollars.
Right. To the city, that was cheap. They basically didn't have a big demonstration in Central Park.
That's and the war in Iraq rolled on, and torture rolled on.
And I'm sure that I'm not sure, but you may well know that they may have said that. Well, there may be
made
a memo floating out there
that
says, look, we may lose this in the end, so it'll cost us some money, but we'll stop the demo. Who are the lawyers?
Marv or Hayden Hilliard and Carl Massinio from the Partnership for Civil Justice in D.C.
They're out of Washington, and they
out
do really
D.C.
good work.
And also New York work,
Well, they're an example of kind of the younger generation of right-on civil rights lawyers.
I mean, if you look at the park issue, you have to combine it with the setting up of the so-called Guantanamo on the Hudson, the mass arrests of people during the Republican convention. Remember, nets thrown over
preventive
people.
Preventive detention,
Free speech zones.
Right. There was essentially a clampdown on protest against the Republicans by the Bloomberg administration. Yeah. So whenever people talk about Bloomberg as someone who's going to go forward and be some kind of liberal if he runs for the nomination. Just remember the Republican convention.
Exactly.
And on a very sad note this week, we've lost an author and activist for peace and social justice.
One of my heroes, really, and a person I know quite well, Philip Agee, the author of Inside the Company, The Diary of the CIA, which in the mid-70s was the first really rogue agent and book that exposed the CIA's dirty tricks throughout the world, but particularly in Central and South America. The book named over 250 agents. It talked about overthrowing governments, subverting labor unions, destroying democracy as really part and parcel of the CIA's job. I received a note a couple of days ago, actually, from Phil's children, Philip Agee Jr. and Chris Agee, who were in Havana with their father at the time of his death. This is from Phil Agee Jr. and Chris Agee. "It is with great sadness that we, the sons of Philip Agee, noted author and activist for peace and social justice, informed the American public and international community that our father passed away peacefully yesterday evening, January 8, 2008, at 10:45 p.m. in Havana due to natural causes. He was 72. We would especially like to extend our sincerest thanks and gratitude to the doctors, nurses, and healthcare workers who lovingly and graciously cared for him during the last days of his life. We would also like to offer our most heartfelt appreciation to all those who, over the course of more than 40 years, have in so many ways demonstrated unwavering support and admiration for his lifelong struggle for peace, social and economic justice, and a better world. Phil Agee Jr., Chris Agee."
Yeah, I've been feeling so sad. He, along with Daniel Ellsberg, were really the two great whistleblowers of that generation. Ellsberg exposed the war in Vietnam, and Agee exposed the murderous counter-revolutionary activity of the CIA, especially in Central and Latin America.
It was probably, Michael and Heidi, the most important book of our generation, because up until then, people looked at what the CIA did, what AFEL did, the American Federation of International Labor Development, which really was put in to subvert progressive labor unions, not as this nasty killer organization. And Phil really exposed its role, I think, from Allende to Mexico to Ecuador to all over Latin America. And, you know, it cost him dearly. He wrote the book in the early 70s. He was living in the United Kingdom where it was first published. It couldn't be published in the United States, or no one would publish it. He was ultimately driven out of the United Kingdom despite having all kinds of progressive parliamentarians on his side. He had to flee really from country to country. His passport was ultimately lifted in an incredibly important case argued by a friend of ours, Mel Wolf, in the Supreme Court, the Phil Agee case. And they lifted the passport on the grounds that his travel was contrary to the foreign interests or the American interests, and that he couldn't travel on an American passport. He then got issued a passport by Grenada. Grenada had a revolution in 1979. It was overthrown in 1983. That's Maurice Bishop was killed. The revolution ended. Agee lost his passport again. He was then given his passport by the Sandinistas, who were in power in Nicaragua. The Sandinistas lost power in the late 80s. Agee lost his passport again. He was at that time residing in Germany with his wife, Giselle, who was a ballerina, who eventually gave him a passport. But he basically spent his time living between Hamburg, Germany, and Havana, Cuba.
He really was a man without a country. He could not come home. The reason he died in Havana was for that very reason. And contrast what he did for noble reasons and to much great effect, contrast what he did with what the Bush people did in exposing Valerie Plame and how none of them ever paid the price at all.
And that's an interesting footnote to the Valerie Plame story. That's the one you recall where Novak and others exposed that Valerie was in the CIA. There's a law in the books called the Agent Identities Identification Act. It prohibits you from exposing, prohibits anyone from exposing the names of CIA agents, even a person who doesn't work for the government, and there's a severe criminal penalty for exposing covert agents. That law was passed, really, to stop Phil Agee and the people he worked with, Bill Shapp, Ellen Ray, and Lou Wolf, who put out a magazine together called Covert Action Intelligence Bulletin, CAIB, and I was one of the attorneys for the magazine at the time that law was passed, and I remember when it was passed. You know, at that time, you could, by being smart and resourceful and looking at diplomatic postings, you could figure out the names of a huge number of CIA agents. And Phil not only knew them from his work, but as a result of CAIB, the Covert Action magazine, would continuously publish them, and they actually put out two books that were written by Phil and Lou Wolf called Dirty Work in Western Europe, and I think Dirty Work in the Far East or wherever. I don't remember where the other one was, but they have long lists of CIA agents in them, and that's what really caused the agent identities law to be passed, which then almost, well, I guess you could argue, you know, got Scooter Libby at least in some way, so hoisted on their own petard in a way. But it was really putting a law in place that was going to allow the CIA to not be exposed and continue its dirty work around the world.
Yes.
Phil is a real treasure. And when I think about it, when you think about the torture scandals now going on and the waterboarding done by the CIA all over the world and what the CIA has been involved in, you'd like to think that Phil Agee would be an example for other CIA agents to come forward and say, we don't want to do this anymore and expose the whole program. But we haven't seen that yet. So Phil is unique. There were some other agents who subsequently came out after him and did some exposure of the agency. Phil was the first, the most important, and we've really lost a major hero.
He wrote an autobiography called On the Run in 1987, in which he chronicles...
It's a marvelous book, and I remember the first chapter when he was stationed in Mexico City in 1968, when all the bad stuff was going on there. There was a slaughter of all the Mexican radical students in the main square and so on. He had a date. He was engaging with this lovely woman over dinner, and he couldn't quite bring himself to tell her exactly what he did and why he was there. And it gnawed on his conscience, and it was that realization of that he finally figured out he was working for the wrong people.
So it's with great sadness at 72 years old. He had a lot of important work left to do, and we really miss him. But he certainly should serve as an example to all of us, to everyone out there, about the effect that you can have as one person to really try and bring down serious illegalities by a particular agency.
And we should add that both of his sons, Phil Jr. and Chris, are activists in the progressive social movement. They learned from their father.
Last week, many organizations and activists staged powerful demonstrations in protest of the sixth anniversary of the U.S. detention camp at Guantanamo Bay and demanding the release of the men held there. Protesters donned masks and their trademark orange suits associated with the prisoners and shuffled through public spaces around the country. We talk with Jemana Musa about the recent demonstrations. Jemana is with Amnesty International USA. She's Advocacy Director for Human Rights and International Justice. Welcome, Jemana, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jemana, can you tell us what your position is on detention camp at Gitmo and also out there in Afghanistan in Abu Ghraib?
Absolutely. I think, you know, you can look to Amnesty International, and we for a long time now have had a policy of calling for the closure of Guantanamo for the people who are there to either be charged with a recognizable crime and given a fair trial in either U.S. federal courts or, if appropriate, a court-martial. But if they're not going to be charged and tried, to be released and be released unconditionally. And I think what's always important to remember about us is certainly we focused on Guantanamo because it's a very visible symbol of what U.S. policy has become in the wake of 9/11 and really a symbol of the sort of derogation on human rights commitments. But it really is just the tip of the iceberg. As it stands right now, there is more than twice the number of people being held in Bagram as were being held in Guantanamo. They have less legal rights. They have less access to the outside world. They don't have representation the way many people in Guantanamo have. And then we still have the issue of secret CIA prisons, which the administration has stated is legal without giving us any legal theory as to why they think it's legal to hide people in secret prisons. Nobody has access to these prisons, and nobody knows who may or may not be in there, what's happened to some of the people who've been held in secret prisons. The administration has reserved the right to render people to other countries where they may face torture or ill treatment, somehow getting around it by saying, oh, but someone promised us they won't be tortured. And so what we see in Guantanamo really encompasses the problems with U.S. counterterrorism policy in the wake of 9/11. But it's just, like I said, the tip of the iceberg.
We were mentioning just as we began the Bagram site. Have you looked at that at all at Amnesty?
Well, we've been to Afghanistan, and we've asked for access on more than one occasion. I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear that we've not been granted access to Bagram. And even though from, you know, all reports are, even though that the ICRC is granted access, they're not granted access to everybody in Bagram either.
The ICRC is the Red Cross.
That usually has access to all prisoners in these kinds of situations.
I understand the Red Cross doesn't gain access right away. So in the intervening time, which could be up to 2 weeks, according to the U.S. government, they can do anything they want to these people within 2 weeks. And moreover, the Red Cross is not speaking about what they see, nor is the government.
Well, I mean, to be fair, it is the way the Red Cross operates. They don't speak publicly about what they see unless they have real extreme concerns that aren't being addressed. But I think you point out quite rightly that the government has about 2 weeks to play with, in which case anything goes. They have people who are hidden from the ICRC, in which case anything goes. And then if you talk about still the looming specter, which this administration has reserved the right to continue to use, secret CIA detentions, nobody has access there. So there's no kind of oversight, not even within 2 weeks, not even within 2 months. So anybody who finds themselves in some kind of secret CIA prison has no protection whatsoever, not the protection of the law, not the protection of observers, nothing.
Even as I recall on the 2 weeks that the Red Cross made a rare public statement where they said that we don't think we're getting access to everybody at Bagram.
That's what I understand as well. And I think whenever you see a public statement from the Red Cross, which of course is different than a leaked report, but whenever you see a public statement, you know that this is not just a small concern because they never speak publicly unless their concern has gotten really severe.
Can you speak with any specificity about what you think is going on in those intervening 2 weeks when the CIA is not accountable?
Well, you know, and I think part of it is, you know, there's two things to look at, right? One is the law that's applicable to DOD facilities. And so the question is this all a DOD facility, or is there part of the facility or part of where they may be keeping people in those 2 weeks that's not a DOD facility?
DOD is Department of Defense for our listeners.
Yes, I apologize for that. And, you know, the key issue with whether or not it's a DOD facility is Congress passed a law that says if you are in a DOD facility, you cannot use any interrogation techniques that are not listed in the Army Field Manual. And the Army Field Manual bans specifically techniques like waterboarding and sexual humiliation, the use of dogs. And right now, that doesn't apply to the CIA if they're not in a DOD facility. And so, you know, there's two questions that are opened up. One is we have an Army Field Manual that somewhat curtails enhanced interrogation techniques, but doesn't say anything about sleep deprivation. It allows isolation, meaning the prolonged use of isolation, which, you know, those of us who work on issues of torture and detention know is a problem in and of itself. And it doesn't prevent stress positions. But once you get out of that DOD facility and with the CIA has a much broader mandate with some classified guidance that, of course, most of us have not seen. And, you know, from what we know now, quite clearly, it's not even guessed that they were waterboarding people. They were taping it and then destroying evidence and using many of these other techniques, which, even if in isolation don't amount to torture, they're usually never used in isolation. They're usually used together. So sleep deprivation, prolonged isolation, what they call temperature manipulation, which could be the use of extreme hot or cold temperature, and sound and light manipulation, all these things together, even if not by themselves, do amount to torture. And so, you know, there's so many questions within the questions, and that's what really begs the issue of independent oversight and why it's so critical to have independent observers like the Red Cross in there. And that's why you should, you know, there should be concern in the fact that they're not getting access.
The items that you ticked off, particularly sleep deprivation, isolation, and the stress position, where a person is really kind of responsible for their own pain that they're in, mm-hmm. those are things that we learned from Al McCoy were developed by the CIA in the 50s at the cost of tens of millions of dollars to really break down the human personality so it can't be put back together again. And I think that you can do that within 2 weeks, and that's what's happening.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think more interesting is they were certainly refined by the CIA, but a lot of them started with the KGB. And so, you know, I mean, there's a lot of dirty roots in terms of where these things came from. And although for a lot of folks, maybe they learned about them in these contexts, and so they hear things like, oh, sleep deprivation, what's the big deal? I don't sleep enough. Or, oh, a stress position, you know, so someone sits in an uncomfortable way. I think they don't recognize both sort of the level to which these techniques have been perfected to achieve exactly what you said, which is to break people down mentally and physically, but also the real physical and mental effects that come from this. Prolonged sleep deprivation is not just something that makes you tired. People can get dissociative, disoriented. It can have physical effects, including effects on people, the functioning of people's internal organs. It can cause chronic pain. And so, you know, these are things that really can sound very benign, and I think this administration in particular is good at sort of taking very nasty, horrible things and making them sound very benign. But in reality, if you talk to the people who have treated torture survivors who have lived through these things, they're very serious techniques.
I have a question for you on your campaign. What are you asking people to do? I know it's a major campaign. It's all over the world. To close Guantanamo, close secret sites, end torture. What kind of actions can they take? What can they do? Where can they go to find out more?
Well, there's a number of things people can do. I will say right now we have obviously our website, which is www.amnestyusa.org. There you'll always find the latest actions. Right now we're targeting the Senate and asking them to pass a provision that was passed by the House, which would restrict the CIA to the techniques available in the Army Field Manual, so they're not sort of operating in this wishy-washy legal world of renaming of techniques, etc. But you can also go to teardown.org and endorse our framework for the end of these unlawful detentions. And that's going to be attached to a larger movement in the United States. We're actually right now in the process of planning and launching a tour of a life-size replica, a maximum security cell from Guantanamo. It was something that was initiated by our Australian section when David Hicks, who was in Guantanamo up until last May, I believe, he was an Australian citizen held in Guantanamo. He's now home and free, although alleged to have been, of course, one of the worst of the worst and the way everybody else is described. But they actually built a life-size replica of the cell that David Hicks was staying in, and they toured it around the country. We now have it here in the U.S., and we're going to be launching a tour. It's going to go around to several sites and have a very interactive component, and you'll be able to see that on our website as well. I think the key thing that people need to do, whether it's with Amnesty or anybody else, is to educate themselves, educate others, and then take action and make sure that the lawmakers here in the United States who represent folks as their constituents, you know, everyone needs to remember we are constituents when we live in this country, need to hear the fact that we want Guantanamo to close. We want them to stop holding people in secret prisons, holding people in Bagram without access to any kind of independent review, hiding people in secret prisons, and that we're going to hold people accountable, that we want to know how they voted, that we're watching how they vote, and that we expect them to vote the right way and take the right vote for human rights.
Jemana, thank you so much.
Again, thanks for having me. And obviously, we couldn't do the work that we do without other lawyers who've done the work they've done, both to bring these cases to the courts and also to bring us the information of the real-life human beings who are being held in the name of national security.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Though the 6th anniversary is a day of acknowledgement of the illegal imprisonment and torture of inmates in Guantanamo, it is also a call on governments across the world to lobby for the release of their residents. More than one-third of Guantanamo prisoners are from Yemen. Yemen is on the Arabian Peninsula in Southwest Asia, bordered by Saudi Arabia to the north and the Red Sea to the west. A conference held in Yemen last week is aiming to secure the release of more Yemeni prisoners from Guantanamo. The conference is encouraging a wide coalition of religious leaders, NGOs, and family members of prisoners to press for the release of the men. Since 2002, 12 Yemeni prisoners have been released from Guantanamo Bay Prison. We talk with Pardis Kebriyai, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who was at the conference. Pardis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We understand you're in Yemen and you're attending a conference on Guantanamo?
Yes. I'm in the capital city of Sana'a right now. There's a conference that began today. It's running for 2 days. And the aim of it is really to speed up the return of the Yemenis who remain at Guantanamo. The Yemenis are the largest group still there. and only, I think, there are over 100 of them who were at Guantanamo since 2002, and only 12 of them have been released since then. So the aim of this conference is really to bring together a large group of parliamentarians, people in government, NGOs, journalists, religious leaders, family members of prisoners, to educate them about what the situation is at Guantanamo and the plight of their prisoners, and then to strategize about how to bring them home.
Are these mostly Yemeni people who were at the conference?
They were all Yemeni, and then we had a group of some American lawyers who are representing them. But there were over 200 people there today. The morning began with the members of government. There was the Minister of Human Rights, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, making statements about wanting to bring the men home, calling for the protection of their rights. And then the afternoon session was really dedicated to, you know, informing families about what the situation is, telling them about the numbers. I think people were really sort of energized by the presentations and by the information, and really sensed the urgency of the situation.
Why do you think that so few Yemenis have been freed? I know Saudi Arabia had an equivalent number, and almost all the
right.
Saudis are out. What is the reason why all the people from Yemen are still at Guantanamo?
I mean, I think some of it is that the case sort of makes it shows itself. I think the government has relied on saying that it's in a weaker position than other countries might be, because if it's weaker political influence, it's not as wealthy as other countries in the region. But I think it's relied on that, and not correctly. I mean, there obviously are examples of European countries or even the Saudis as being, you know, having closer ties to the U.S. and being more powerful or wealthier countries economically or geopolitically. But it's not enough any longer for the Yemeni government to be saying that that is the reason why the Yemenis aren't home. There are examples of other countries in the region and outside of the region that are not as strong and as wealthy as, for example, the European countries, but that have brought most of their prisoners home. At this point, it's really Yemen that just completely stands out. Again, I mean, 12 men in 6 years, and the Yemenis now make up a third of the population at Guantanamo. Just unacceptable.
During this first day of the conference, what were some of the ideas, suggestions about strategies to change the situation?
We were really presenting them with case studies of other countries. We talked about the Saudi Arabian example. I think that was useful for them to see at some level. There was also some questions about how possible a program of reintegration, rehabilitation like the Saudis have done, which is pretty specific to the Saudi Arabian context, and that's obviously a wealthier country with close ties to the U.S., and that is not Yemen. But I think it was also just useful for them to see that was a country that developed a strategy internally, a strategy that was acceptable both to the Saudi Arabian government and the U.S. government, and that in the past year, so many Saudis have been repatriated. So we talked about case studies of other countries, what other countries have done, strong political statements that high-level officials have made, the role of the media and journalists in humanizing, you know, the stories of the men there and just informing people about what's going on, the pressure that NGOs can bring to bear. I thought one thing that was very interesting was that a couple of imams spoke about what they could do, and in terms of one of the ideas was that they proposed writing sermons about Guantanamo and taking it back to their mosques and every week talking about one of the Yemenis at Guantanamo, and perhaps even having each mosque in the country adopt a prisoner, literally, and just tell their stories and sort of mobilize their communities around that person.
This sounds incredibly moving to me sitting here just hearing you speak, and how effective I think it can be. I mean, I know that's in England and some of the other countries that got people freed, sort of grassroots movement in the families. If you can tell us some of the stories about the families and what they said and the impact of these imprisonments on them.
It was really heart-wrenching. I mean, and that's, I think, the families and the impact on them. And we talk a lot about what the prisoners go through at Guantanamo, and that's horrific. But there's also just families that have been devastated. And we heard from some mothers, and there were children holding pictures of their fathers or their brothers sitting up at the front of the room, and they were just there the entire day. But we heard about, there was one woman who came forward and just talked about how her children had had to drop out of school because economically the family had been dependent on their father, obviously, who's at Guantanamo, to make ends meet. The kids had to drop, one of the children had to drop out of school to work to help his family. And I just think we don't hear enough about the impact on the families as well. These are men who earned incomes for their families, provided for them, and it's been 6 years that they've been locked up in Guantanamo. So we heard a lot about that. We talked a lot about the men at Guantanamo, but there, the very few Yemenis who've been returned. There were some family members who were there talking about just the devastating effects of the imprisonment on them and just the difficulty the men are going through now back home, just severe mental health issues, really having trouble reintegrating into life. So it was incredibly moving to hear those stories.
Now, on the second day of the conference, you've just finished the first day. What's going to happen on the second day?
Tomorrow, we're going to hear more from detainees who've been released, just telling their stories about what they went through. And we're also, in the afternoon, going to try to leave with some action items and really come out with a plan, which I think is what makes this conference a little bit different. What was different about this time, and there have been conferences in Yemen before, but this time really brought together just a huge number of people. There were literally 250 people here traveling from all parts of the country, and just a really diverse group, a broad coalition. So tomorrow, hopefully, we can really put our heads together and come out with a plan. And I think this idea of the imams writing sermons and going to their mosques and talking about the prisoners at Guantanamo was so interesting. And they're planning to take the ideas and the information that we talked about over these 2 days and take it back to their mosques and start there on January 11th. You know, we'll organize and come out with some strategies, but hear a lot also from prisoners who've been released.
And Pardis, do you know how many prisoners who were released are there?
With us, there were about six right now. But again, in all, it's a very small number. It's 12 total. Again, I just can't get over that. We were just doing some comparisons in terms of numbers. And again, if you take the Saudis, they had over 130 prisoners there. 13 of them remain now. And fewer Yemenis have been released. 12 Yemenis have been released.
Wait, there's about 98 Yemenis left in Guantanamo. Is that right?
Right. Over 90, almost 100.
Right. I guess part of the strategy here, it seems to me, is to pressure somehow the Yemeni, or at least open up the eyes of the Yemeni government to these facts. And what's been the newspaper coverage like? Maybe it's too early. Maybe it'll be after the conference.
I think we've talked a lot with just NGOs here, and in the conversations we've had, the press, surprisingly and very positive, is actually very open and is able to report pretty independent outlets. So they've been strong in sort of criticizing what we've read so far, the Yemeni government, for not doing enough and for making these occasional statements every once in a while on an anniversary talking about the importance of making efforts to bring the men home, but really just not backing that up with political will or effective and meaningful action.
The number is really embarrassing, I mean, I would think.
It really is embarrassing, and I think people felt that today. I mean, again, for the Yemenis to now be the largest group of prisoners there, making up a third of the population, and for only 12 men to have been repatriated is an embarrassment, and I think people felt that very strongly. There were a lot of local and national papers there. I think it's going to get great coverage, again, just because we had very high-level officials there. We had a lot of family members there. There was a large group of American lawyers, which I think also brought some attention. So hopefully the coverage will be very good. And what we've read in the past few days also has been fair and objective and strong, pushing the government to do more than make these good, positive, but just occasional statements.
This conference has really been, in effect, a consciousness-raising event.
I would absolutely say that. I mean, I think people just didn't know, just didn't have the information. And again, at a grassroots level, at a community-based level, it's hard for people to get information that we have and that we read about maybe in the European and American press all the time, but just didn't have the numbers and the facts, and weren't really brought together in this way either, the family members even, and NGOs and people who care about the issue but just had not connected. So I think it was really, really productive and powerful in that way to bring people together and just share information. And I think that will mobilize them and hopefully generate a lot of pressure on the government.
Did the conference cover at all how these prisoners got to Guantanamo in the first place? And I'm specifically interested in the issue of bounty hunters.
Right. It actually did. And it was so powerful to see. One of the presentations literally was talking about who are the Yemenis there. And one of the things the Yemeni government has been saying, which I guess has been a sticking point, one of the sticking points in bringing the men home and in terms of their limited steps they've taken so far in pressing their release, is because there's been some concern that these men are dangerous and that they're terrorists. And we really talked today about who these men are and the issue of bounty hunters and these flyers and amounts of money that were essentially given to people to capture and turn the Yemenis, like most of the other prisoners at Guantanamo, over to U.S. authorities. The audience was able to see what these bounty flyers actually looked like, and it was just so effective for the audience, the family members, and, you know, community members to see that, and also for the government. And it was literally, one of the flyers was, which many members in your audience may be familiar with, but an Arab on one side, it was a piece of paper divided into three, with an Arab man on one side, U.S. dollar bills in the middle, with an arrow pointing to the next portion of the paper, which was the Arab man behind bars. So literally saying, you know, if you see an Arab, we'll give you money so that you can help us put him behind bars. And it was just incredibly powerful for the government to see that, for the audience to see that. So once these men were captured, they were essentially tortured and coerced into confessing to crimes that they, or to actions that they didn't commit. So we really got today at the issue of most of these men, like most of the Yemenis, like most of the men at Guantanamo, are wholly innocent of any kind of crime. Beyond innocence, though, the point is that none of them have been offered any process. So, and it's been 6 years, they've just been sitting there. And unless there's pressure, the U.S., you know, can continue to hold them indefinitely.
I didn't hear about that flyer, but the one that said, you know, you can be rich, you will not have to work for the rest of your life, you can buy all the animals.
Exactly. But the amounts of money, again, when you're talking about lower-income country people who in Yemen live on $1 a day, the average person lives on $1 to $2 a day. I mean, these are the levels of income of some of these countries that we're talking about. People being offered between $5,000 and $10,000 or more U.S. dollars. I mean, that's an incredible amount of money. And these bounties were being offered in areas like Pakistan and Afghanistan. But still, we're talking about very low income, very poor people, and this is just an incredible amount of money. It was just completely coercive. But that's how a lot of the men landed in Guantanamo.
Pardis, how did the families react when they saw those flyers?
There was a lot of silence in the room. I mean, it was an incredibly powerful atmosphere. Saw a lot of tears. It was a wonderful combination of, you know, bringing together a really broad coalition of people and talking about political strategies, but also just the human stories of the men and really having people share stories about their families and their brothers and sons and tribesmen sitting at Guantanamo. And we had a group of relief detainees there also. We'll talk more tomorrow, but they were talking a little bit today about their experiences. And then the children just sitting up there holding pictures of their fathers. There's a lot of emotion in the room, a lot of silence. People were just really, you know, really paying attention. And I think everyone felt the power of having that group there in the room.
Pardis, I know you're traveling a lot and doing a lot of work on really trying to get people out of Guantanamo. To the extent you can you tell us what the rest of your trip is going to be like and what kind of work you're going to be engaged in?
Sure. Again, you know, follow-up is going to be key to this conference. This was a tremendous opportunity, but it will be a lost opportunity unless we can really organize and develop some action points and follow up on them. And the conferences have been held in the past. We really just don't want this to be another conference. I think this was different than the others, again, because of the numbers of people who've been brought together, because we're talking about 6 years, and because, it is an embarrassment to the Yemeni government and to Yemeni citizens that their people make up the largest group of prisoners at Guantanamo now. So follow-up is going to be key. We're really going to focus on that when we return. But also, you know, the Yemenis are a large group, the largest group there, but the Afghans are other populations that still have many, way too many people there at Guantanamo. And we know the litigation is important, but that's not what's getting the men home. So these advocacy strategies and these conferences and this kind of lobbying is really what's key, what eventually will help Guantanamo shut down. I mean, the fact that the Saudis over 130 of them have been returned home. And that's one of the ways that Guantanamo essentially will close down, is where countries with very large populations secure the release of their men and the population reduces. So if the Yemenis are similarly successful, we're talking about 100 less people at Guantanamo, considering that the population is slightly less than 300. I mean, that's a significant reduction. So that's really how I think Guantanamo is going to close. But after, you know, in addition to the follow-up and the work in Yemen, we're also traveling to Afghanistan. Explorers from CCR, myself, probably another lawyer, and some other U.S. attorneys are traveling to Kabul, hopefully in February, to do a similar kind of effort there to get the Afghans out of Guantanamo, because they're the second largest population.
Well, Pardis, we really want to thank you. I mean, you're doing amazing work, and it's really a moment that was very moving to hear you speak.
Hopefully 2008 will be a better year.
Pardis, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All around the country, from Washington, D.C. to Boise, Idaho, last Friday over 20 demonstrations were held, marking the 6th anniversary of the Guantanamo Bay military camp. Wearing orange to symbolize the color of the jumpsuits worn by the first Guantanamo detainees, protesters turned out in huge numbers to send the message that the Bush policy of indefinite detention and torture is illegal, unconstitutional, and a disgrace to this country. On Friday, we caught up with Vince Warren from the protest in Washington, D.C. Vince is executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which has been representing detainees in Guantanamo since their initial confinement there. Vince, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Heidi, it's great to be talking with you.
And thanks for joining us literally from the streets of D.C. Tell us what's happening down there right now.
Well, today, as you know, is the 6th anniversary of the date when the first men were brought to Guantanamo, and there was a very large rally down here at the Washington Mall where a great number of people were dressed in orange jumpsuits, where people remained in stress positions, which were the positions the detainees were forced to be in during the speeches. It was incredibly invigorating and inspiring to see all of these people down here.
Now, is there going to be civil disobedience when they reach the front of the Supreme Court?
It's not clear. There might very well be people who will be moving into the Supreme Court to demand justice for the Guantanamo detainees. And if that does happen, I expect it'll be very powerful.
We know that CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights, has been involved in defending Guantanamo detainees really since the very beginning. What message does CCR want to get out there today?
The important thing to remember is 6 years ago today, the first detainees were brought over. 1 month from that point, you know, in February of this year will be 6 years when we filed the first habeas corpus petition. We were the first people to have a lawyer to go down to visit the detainees ever. We were the first organization to have a lawyer visit the black site detainees this year. And we've been to the Supreme Court 3 times. Every time we've been to the Supreme Court and won, Congress has come back and tried to undo the victories that we've made in the court. So I think the message that we want to send forth is this, that while there are 3 branches of government that are involved in this 9/11 nonsense, there's a 4th branch of government that is really important, and that's the people. Of the 770 people that have been in Guantanamo, over 400 have been released, and not one has been released by the court, and not one has been released by Congress. And it's really been the vigilance of people like at the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Habeas Council, and people of conscience that have raised this issue and essentially forced the government to release people that it knows that have had no connection to terrorists and not a terrorism and aren't threats. The other thing, Heidi, is that we need to move beyond Guantanamo. It's been 6 years of this sort of craziness, and we need to be thinking about what the next steps are. And it's important to remember that the next president can undo virtually all of this with a stroke of a pen within the first 100 days.
Well said. And we know that George W. Bush is still denying that this country does not engage in torture. Let's hope that the message that all of you are out there bringing at least resounds with some of the new presidential candidates.
Yes, I completely agree. And it's insane that he seems to be the only person to these days that believes that the government doesn't torture. We've known that for years. We've been trying to bring those issues to court, and that's the reason why the Bush administration is trying to keep lawyers out and keep the detainees from out of court, because they're trying to hide that they've been doing this torture, and very viciously, for all of these years. And of course, when it comes out that there's evidence of it, then it comes out that they're destroying the tapes. So it's kind of convenient for President Bush to say we don't do it when he's actively got people that are destroying the evidence.
Vince, are you wearing orange today?
I'm wearing a very bright orange tie.
Excellent. Keep up the great work. We wish we were down there with you.
Heidi, thanks so much for having me on the show. People that are listening should take every opportunity to get out into the streets. This is the time when we need everybody most. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.